Okay, welcome back, B'Siyata D'Shmaya. This is part number three of the event that we did for educators, mechanchim, teaching about compulsive sexual behavior. If you have a bachur, an avreich, a neighbor, a friend, a son, a father that has these problems. So we were speaking about what defines addiction. That was in the beginning. We spoke about other issues that sometimes overlap with addiction and sometimes complicate addiction, whether that's other mental health issues like depression, anxiety, and so on, or whether that's a type of paraphilia or other sexual issue that is mixed with addiction, and now they overlap together and there's this complex animal. It's not a simple addiction, it's not a simple paraphilia, it's some sort of thing that works together. So we spoke about that. We moved on. We spoke about treating the environment and treating the problems inside the person's mind and how those two things are important and they work together. We spoke about how addiction is chronic, and even if a person gets better from addiction, in other words, they stop drinking, they stop looking at pornography, they stop masturbating, whatever the thing is, the point is there may be and usually will be some level of maintenance that the person has to do in order to keep up the status quo of being safe from going back to his addiction. And like we said last time, some people do that by going to a 12-step group, which we'll get to later on talking about that. They may even go weekly their entire life, or even every day. There are other people that maintain their recovery in a much more minimal way. Maybe it's making certain lifestyle changes and making sure to do those every day, or whether it's meditation or learning certain things. There are many ways of doing maintenance. Okay, so here we go. Now we're talking on slide 22 about measuring recovery. Okay, in case you don't have the slide, email me avitenenbaum9@gmail.com, avitenenbaum9@gmail.com. So how do you measure recovery? In other words, let's assume we have an addicted guy that we're talking about. I want to know, is this person getting better? So you'll tell me, yeah, look, he stopped looking at pornography, or he stopped calling up all sorts of things on the phone. He stopped meeting with all sorts of women in town. Well, that's a great way to start recovering, but in and of itself, simply stopping that behavior is not sufficient to be considered recovery on its own. So I'm going to read the words of the slide. Recovery from addiction includes the behavior is stopped. That's obvious, right? He used to drink, he stops drinking. That was very obvious. But why or how did he stop? Did he stop simply by a display of willpower? He's kind of forcing himself from not drinking? Because if he's doing that, studies show, by the way, willpower doesn't last very long. I mean, willpower is great for getting you to stand up and do something, but willpower isn't necessarily something that you can rely on all the time your whole life. And therefore, is this guy just stopping to drink or stopping to look at pornography because he's forcing himself away? So number one, willpower doesn't work very well. So if he's just doing this for willpower, it's not really good. Aside from that, willpower is kind of painful and it uses a lot of energy. And this guy is just going to be all for tumult and all busy forcing himself away from drinking or forcing himself away from pornography or from arayos, whatever it was he was doing. So he's not really going to be available to grow and to do other things that he needs to do. Okay, so we're talking about recovery, and we're talking about, first of all, stopping the behavior. How is he stopping the behavior? Is he doing this simply by forcing himself away, or is he actually working? He's taking particular steps of growth. And those steps of growth are showing me he's changing, he's working on himself, he's working on the different issues in his mind, in the environment, different things that happened that kind of brought him to this place. Okay? We're going to want to see not only people stopping cold turkey right away, as people call cold turkey, there's even people that can stop warm turkey, which means that I'm seeing this person gradually taking steps of growth. Where he used to, let's say, act out and be Maitzi Zer Levatela addictively 4 times a day, this week he's doing it 3 times a day, okay? And next week, 2 times a day, and a month from now, 1 time a day. And that sort of reduction as long as we can track that, and that has to do with growth that this person is doing and steps that he's taking in recovery, you would assume this person is on the road to recovery. He's not just forcing himself away from this behavior. I mean, you could even ask him, when you told me, Yanko, this week that you only was Moitzi Zarah Lovatela 2 times every day instead of 4, how did you manage to do that? Was that a big struggle for you? And even if it was a big struggle, like, do you feel that you're going in the right direction? What did you do to get there? Did you just stop, decide this and just force yourself away? Or you took certain steps, or you worked on certain issues, which helped you to accomplish that? Okay? When you talk about the topic of warm turkey versus cold turkey, there is so much to talk about. It's way beyond our topic. Okay, you also want to see if this guy is growing, not only in abstinence or stopping from the behavior, not only in reducing the amount of time or duration that he did this behavior, but also you want to see, is he growing socially? Is he being more productive? Is he being more spiritual? Is he being more religious, if that's what he's trying to do? How is his psychological health? Is it better? Is his physical health better? Is he taking better care of himself? Is he going to sleep on time? You know, this guy used to stay up looking at pornography all night. Is he taking care of that now? He used to never eat. He would skip all his meals because he was busy doing his addiction. Is he eating now like a mensch, like the way a Jew has to eat to serve Hashem? Is his life more or less in balance now? Are things a lot better? Is he more mature? How are his relationships with other people? Is he growing in the way that he relates to his wife? Or in the way that he relates to chavrusas or other people? Okay, so there's a lot of domains in a person's life that we're going to want to look and see growth. Okay, and obviously, recovery is ultimately defined by growth. By growth, also in all these domains in life, and also obviously growth in stopping the behavior. Okay. I'm going to skip slide 23. We don't have time for that. Okay, slide 24 is pretty important. It's talking about relapse. In other words, once a person has recovered, and now you call this guy a recovered person, and he's able to maintain that status for a long time. I mean, a significant amount of time. He's recovered. He has lifestyle balance. He just keeps growing and growing. He stopped doing the behavior, and he's just going from madriga to madriga in growth. And then this guy goes back to his addiction, let's say a year later for the sake of example. You might call that a relapse. In other words, this guy grew. He recovered, so to speak. For the whole year, he did different things to maintain that situation. And then, at the end of that year, he relapsed. Okay? That's kind of a example of a guy who had recovery and then lost it. Okay? But I want to talk about the person before that period of time. When you have a bachur who is in treatment, or he's in a 12-step group, or he's on Guard Your Eyes, or whatever tool he's using to get better from this behavior, and you see him falling and you see him slipping during this time where he's trying to get better, I wouldn't necessarily call that a relapse, because this guy never got better yet for it to be considered a relapse. In other words, it's important to bear in mind, when a person is starting to try to recover, it takes time to learn how to recover. And in slide 24, we compare it to learning how to ride a bike. And that mashal is the mashal of one of the world's biggest experts on relapse, which is, his name was Dr. Alan Marlatt. This was his mashal, that it takes time to learn how to ride a bike. During the time that you learn how to ride a bike, you might fall off a few times. And of course, you never throw yourself off the bike on purpose. So a bachur can't use as an excuse, Rebbe, look, of course I was with a Zainan last night. I'm just learning how to do this. You know, you can't use it as an excuse. We have to try our best. The Bachar has to try his best. He has to do everything that is prescribed to him and that is necessary to recover from his addiction and to do whatever he needs to do. However, Bidi Eved, after this person fell, Nemafreya, if you're trying to understand where this guy is holding, you do have to bear in mind that on some level, it takes time to learn how to stop using, or how to stop drinking, or how to stop gambling. That takes time. It's a skill. It takes time. Actually, breaking an addiction is one of the hardest things to do in the world. So bear that in mind. Of course, the Bachar, like I said, can't throw himself off the bike on purpose. He has to try to learn to ride a bike. But if he falls off the bike while he's trying to learn, he gets back on the bike and he keeps on learning how to ride the bike until he becomes good at riding bikes. Okay? I feel it's important also when we talk about a Bachar who started steps of recovery but fell. I feel it's very important to differentiate between high-risk and low-risk situations. This I also got from Dr. Marlatt. And what that means is that you have a Bachar who, he's addicted to pornography, and let's, for the sake of example, and this guy used to go to internet cafes, or he used to, you know, do things like this, and he worked really hard with his therapist, or maybe he went to the SA group, or whatever he did, and he got better. I mean, he really grew a lot, and he was sober for 30 days or 60 days, whatever it is, and he's really doing great. He's on the road to recovery, and comes Bein HaZmanim, and Bein HaZmanim, he goes home. There's 10 computers in the house without a filter. He's got 10 hours a day with nothing to do. All of his friends live in different places. You know, he's got this unstructured situation. Maybe his parents even fight at home. I don't know the situation. But the point is, that's a higher risk situation. And if he falls in a high risk situation, so you have to bear in mind the context of that situation. You say, Shlomi, okay, I heard you're not doing well over there at home. It sounds to me, though, like that's a pretty high-risk situation. And I remember that before you left to go home, you were doing pretty well. So I don't want you to walk away thinking, Shlomi, that you're not matzliach at all. It sounds like you were being matzliach, you're doing pretty good in a kind of regular and lower-risk situation. And I think when you come back, Bezrat Hashem, we can get back there again, and we can keep trying from there until you get so strong that even a high-risk situation you'll be able to overcome. Okay? So making that chilek, making that differentiation between high-risk and low-risk situations is very, very hard. Very, very important, I mean to say. Okay? Moving on to slide 25. This is something that I do sometimes with new clients. And I think any Rebbe, any coach, any person can do this. I call it the Cliff Model for the sake of a better name. Feel free to email me a better name. And the idea is that there's an edge to this cliff, right? And when he falls off the edge, that means he's back into his addiction. He's doing the behavior that he doesn't want to be doing. And I try to make on a paper a figurative cliff. Okay, you can see on the bottom of slide 25, there's a volcano at the end of this cliff with alligators inside. And I know that doesn't make much sense, but just pretend, for example, that could be. And I have three places on this cliff until the cliff edge, okay? Right by the edge of the cliff, you have the cliff edge, right? That's a very dangerous place to be. It's not safe for a person to stand 2 feet away from the edge of a nefariously tall cliff on top of a volcano. So that's a dangerous place to be. And I want to help my client, or this Bachar, find tools when he's standing at the cliff edge. Okay, so there are very drastic tools that maybe don't work that well, but they're kind of drastic, they're kind of extreme. But you know, for a person standing on the cliff edge, that's what you need to do to get away from the cliff edge. Okay, so for example, I'm not sure if I like this example so much, but this is an example that somebody did recently. He was meeting with his Rebbe. He said, Rebbe, I feel like I'm about to go do something really bad. The Rebbe said, get in a cab, go to the Kaisal, stand there for 2 hours, and come home. Okay, if that works, that works. The point is, it's to do something quick, fast, extreme. Get away from that cliff edge, okay? Whatever will help the Bachar get away from the edge of that cliff. Okay, obviously the best thing to do is to interview the Bachar himself, not to tell him what he should do, but maybe to interview him and collaboratively to figure out, what do you need to do right now to help you get away from the cliff edge? Okay, so you have tools like that. And I would actually make this picture of a cliff, and on top of the section right near the cliff edge, I would write there different tools. Three or four things you can do when you're standing by the cliff edge, when you're in that dangerous, slippery place where you're about to fall, and you don't want to fall, and you don't want to go back to your addiction, you don't want to go back to acting out. What can you do? The second stage or place on this cliff is farther away from the cliff edge. It's like, let's say, 10, 15, 20 feet away. It's a person moving towards the direction of the edge of the cliff. So being 20 feet away from a nefariously tall cliff is also not really a good idea. If you don't need to be there for some important reason, you probably shouldn't be there. So when I see a person moving towards the cliff edge, in other words, it's a bacher that I see he's kind of going to the wrong direction. He's not in such a good place right now, and I can imagine that if this continues, he's eventually going to be in the cliff edge within a shortened amount of time, matter of days or matter of weeks. So then we make tools for that place as well. I say, Shlaimi, you know, I kind of see, or what, based on what you're telling me, it sounds like you're moving towards the direction of the cliff edge. You're not there today, but it doesn't sound like you're exactly in the best place. It sounds like you're moving in that direction. What are things that you can do today to kind of bring yourself back to that good, healthy place so that you're not walking towards the cliff edge? Okay? And then finally, we have tools of status quo. Status quo is, let's say, 300 feet away from the cliff edge. You're way in the range of safety. You're fine. Over there, everything is okay. Even the strongest wind is not going to blow you off the cliff edge. And those are the things that a person does every single day to kind of maintain the status quo. There are things that help him be in a healthy place. Alan Marlatt calls it lifestyle balance, things that give you lifestyle balance. And obviously, a bacher that sleeps like a behemoth and eats like a behemoth, keeps his dira like a behemoth, doesn't keep to any starim, doesn't really enjoy his learning, doesn't really keep himself socially healthy, he's got 25 different things going on, he doesn't have lifestyle balance. And when you don't have lifestyle balance, you move towards the edge of the cliff. But quite the opposite is true as well. If you have the bacher or avrich that he keeps himself clean and neat, he eats properly like a mensch, he goes to sleep like a mensch, he has starim, and he tries to be punctual, and he takes responsibility. And, you know, he has proper social relationships to be able to share with other people what's going on. And whatever the things are that he needs to keep the status quo, it's even being matzliach in yeshiva. If you're matzliach in yeshiva, you put in time to listen to shir, you know, and it's a matter of just putting in some extra time, and you could be matzliach in doing that, and you feel good about yourself. That's something that's important for recovery. That keeps the status quo. That gives a person safety, and that keeps them away, far away from the cliff edge. Okay? So the idea on one line is to build a repertoire of tools that will keep the Talmud away from the cliff edge. Okay, so here it looks like we're just going to talk a few words about a few different common therapies out there that are successful in treating addiction. These aren't an exclusive list, so there are other things out there that are helpful. But it's important to bear in mind, not every therapy is helpful for addiction. Some of them are even destructive and make a person in a worse place. So proceed with caution. Okay, so slide 26. This is solution-focused therapy, or brief solution-focused therapy, SFT, BSFT. It's a collaborative model where a therapist, this is a type of individual psychotherapy, it's where a therapist works together with a bacher to understand, were they ever matzliach in the past? What was it that they're doing? And how could they do more of it? Okay? Especially if a person has very limited time in treatment, it's a handy, brief treatment. I oversimplified it. You can learn more about it however you go about doing that on the internet or wherever you can find out about it. But it is a external, it's a shitchiistika model. It works fairly well on a certain level. Obviously, simply strategizing and finding solutions isn't going to get to very deep core problems, and that maybe is a liability of this model. But when you can only meet a bacher two or three times and then he's going home for college and you're never going to see him again, this could be a very handy resource, this approach. Okay, going to slide 27, we have motivational interviewing. There's a common myth, which unfortunately pervaded the Jewish people, which is that if a person is not yet willing to get better from addiction, in other words, he refuses to stop, he's not really motivated, so what you have to basically do is let him die and just watch him bleed away to death. And eventually he'll hit bottom, and he'll hit bottom so hard that he'll maybe wake up, and hopefully if he survives that fall, he'll come running back to beg you to help him. Anything other than that, you basically just have to let him go and let him suffer for 10 years, lose his house, lose his wife and kids, and maybe become fry and homeless until he becomes motivated to get better. Now, of course, that is a method of motivation, but it's kind of b'dyavad, isn't it? So, in the 1980s, some scientists developed a beautiful model of therapy called motivational interviewing. So this is not even my chiddush, and it's not even something new. This is 30 plus years old, motivational interviewing. There are therapists that are skilled in doing this model, and it's a whole beautiful method of helping people to become more motivated to make changes towards recovery. Okay, let's say that there are 5 stages of motivation and 5 stages of recovery, and the therapist is trained to assess where the client is holding in these 5 stages and to help facilitate his moving slowly along in his pace to finally making that big change, stopping to drink, stopping to act out, stopping to go to the prostitutes or whatever it is that the person is doing. It's a very, very important method to know, and this is one of the main evidence-based tools in a true addiction specialist's arsenal. Okay, so you should know it's out there. Okay, slide 28, you have mindfulness and urge surfing. Okay, mindfulness, biktsara, very, very briefly, is a type of meditation. It's not a religious meditation. You don't have to fold your legs, and you don't have to have a pestle of Buddha in the room. It's a certain way of breathing. It's a certain way of paying attention. If you're not sitting here in the room with me, it's quite hard to say over just on a recording what it is. But the name of it is meditation, mindfulness meditation. Mindfulness is extremely effective. It's also been studied for about 30 years, and it's been so highly effective for addiction and many other problems, by the way, that it's been incorporated into many of today's cutting-edge therapies, including DBT, MCBT, ACT, MBRP, all the funny names that sound crazy when I say them to you. All these therapies use mindfulness. It's a very, very powerful, simple, easy-to-learn tool. It's a type of tool that you can teach a bachar and he could do it on his own. And that's one of my favorite things about mindfulness, is it's not just the therapist doing it with him. You can teach him these skills, and then on his own, in his room in the dorm, when he goes home being his manan, he could do this on his own. When a person does mindfulness meditation, what he's basically doing is he's learning how to change his relationship with the way he relates in general to all of his thoughts, all of his feelings, all of his emotions. It's very, very powerful and very helpful. Okay, so we spoke about SFT, solution-focused therapy, so far. We said that that's a simple way, a brief way of interviewing someone to help them figure out solutions to their problem. We spoke about motivational interviewing, which is the chachma of how to help motivate someone who's not really motivated. And we spoke about mindfulness, and urge surfing, by the way, is a type of mindfulness which is applied specifically to addiction. Okay, University of Washington, they were the one that coined that phrase, urge surfing, if I'm not mistaken. But mindfulness is just, it's a really important tool to know. Okay, slide 29, we're going to talk about cognitive behavioral therapy. There are many types of cognitive behavioral therapy, but CBT, as it's called, is also very powerful, very helpful, evidence-based form of treatment that can help people with addiction. Until now, by the way, solution-focused therapy, motivational interviewing, and CBT, those are all things that are done between a therapist and the bachur. But mindfulness, it also can and probably should be done by a therapist, but there are all sorts of groups out there where even laymen teach mindfulness, and it's very powerful. A person can even learn how to do mindfulness, by the way, on his own. He can watch some videos, he can listen to some recordings, and even teach himself. There are, if a person has a smartphone, there's a way to get apps on the phone, which are pretty kosher apps. There's all sorts of apps out there that they basically walk you through the steps of how to learn it and how to do it. And if you're the type of person that you feel is allowed for yourself to have such a phone, then you can download one of those apps. Obviously, you should have a filter on your phone. Okay. Going to slide 30, the 12 steps. The 12 steps, we could talk about the 12 steps for a week. Okay, the 12 steps is a very powerful, old method of treatment for addiction. There's a lot to talk about. Basically, it's 12 spiritual principles that when a person applies these 12 principles to his life, they have found that it can help people to free themselves from the jail of addiction. Okay. Usually the 12-step groups Sorry, usually the 12 steps are practiced in a group form. In other words, there's a weekly or daily meeting that a person goes to, and he practices these 12 steps with the other people that practice 12 steps. They have a meeting where they talk together about applying the 12 steps to their addiction and how that works for them and what they need to improve on. Each person talks from his own experience about himself and how he tries to use the 12 steps to grow. What else can we say about the 12 steps? I mean, there's just so much. There's so much. Okay. It's important when we talk about the 12 steps, when we talk about CBT, talk about mindfulness. All these things are tools. And they don't necessarily work for everybody. They work for somebody. They work for some people, not for other people. Any person who's dogmatic and says that everybody should be helped by CBT, or everybody can be helped by mindfulness, or everybody can be helped by the 12 steps, it's not true. Each person has their own needs in recovery. The best thing that I recommend, if this is possible, is that a person, a bachar, let's say, who has this problem, or an avrich that has a possible addictive disorder, I recommend that they go to an addiction specialist who can do an assessment with them, ask them a lot of questions, try to understand the nature of their problem. What are the different ingredients in their problem? Are there co-occurring mental health issues aside from addiction, etc.? And then accordingly, based on that assessment, that professional should have a good idea of a recommendation for what type of tool might be good for this person. And by the way, people can't always afford therapy, so maybe they need a free tool, okay? Or people maybe don't want to go to the 12-step group because their brother or father is in the 12-step group and there's only one meeting in town. And then his father is going to see this guy walking in, okay? So people have all sorts of personal considerations and needs when it comes to what type of treatment might work for them, and that's very important to bear in mind. It's important to say about the 12 steps. It's a beautiful group. There's a lot to talk about it. There's some controversy about it as well. I actually wrote a lot on this. If anyone wants to ask me questions by email, I'm happy to try to field those answers. But it's a free resource all around the world. In basically every single developed country, they have a 12-step group. All the groups work the same, more or less. Like I said, people go to this group and they try to read the literature of the 12 steps and practice these 12 steps. There's a minhag in the 12-step group where you have something called a sponsor. And a sponsor is basically where you take for yourself a madrich, a counselor, a guide, that this person has already successfully somewhat recovered from addiction for a year, for 5 years, 5 months. They have some sort of time on their belt, significant time ahead of you. And they got better through this method of the 12 steps. They've taken these 12 spiritual principles and applied it to their own situation, to their own life, and through that they've grown, they've advanced, and gotten better from recovery, and they're willing to share with the sponsee, with this bachar, how they did that, okay? So they kind of guide the person through that process. Okay, going to slide 31, Guard Your Eyes. Guard Your Eyes is a great website. It's guardyoureyes.com, very easy to look up on the internet. It's an online forum for firm people who are on many different levels. Some of them have addiction, a lot of them actually, and I heard from some of the people that are behind the making of the beautiful site Guard Your Eyes, most of the people there don't necessarily have addiction, but they have some sort of a struggle with pornography or things like this. But there's people on a whole spectrum. There's all sorts of people there, and they all get together. They have an online anonymous forum where you don't even need to say your name. You can make up your own code name there. They have online meetings and phone meetings. They read things together. There's all sorts of recordings that they send out, articles they send out. There's also all sorts of conversations and chats that they have together about how to recover and how to grow and how to break free from these problems. They encourage the 12-step method over there for people that they think might need that. In other words, that Guard Your Eyes is not sufficient, and so on. Okay. Slide 32 is about inpatient treatment. Inpatient is basically where you take a guy and you lock him up in a facility for whether it's 21 days, it's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. Each program is a different amount of days. Obviously, when a person is locked up in a rehab, he doesn't really have access or the ability to do his addiction. So if it's a rehab for the type of issues that we're talking about, they make sure people that are addicted to pornography won't have access for 30 days to pornography. That itself is helpful. And then once they're already stuck without having access for 30 days, well, what are they going to do all day? They're going to go mashuga. What do? So they teach them all sorts of important skills. They have lots of therapy there, group therapy, individual therapy, and so on. Okay, so that's a type of tool out there in the world. I personally have sent people to inpatient treatment very few times in my whole life. I mean, it's an extreme move, and for somebody that needs it, it is a mitzvah and it's very important. But I feel always it's important to have the patient, have the buffer, meet with a professional that understands the different types of treatment out there and that can recommend the right type of treatment. If this guy doesn't need to go to outpatient program and he can get by with individual therapy or he can get by with outpatient program, which we'll talk about in a second. So chaval to kind of like rip him out of his yeshiva, rip him out of life and rip him out of his family for 60 or 90 days. If it's necessary, it's necessary. Okay, but there's a lot of shikulim, there's a lot of things that a person has to bear in mind, and I think that it's a very important idea to send this person for an assessment and recommendation by a therapist that understands all the tools out there and can understand what the person needs. When we talk about therapy or we talk about rehab or inpatient, outpatient, it's also very important to remember that there's all sorts of rehabs out there. There's all sorts of therapists out there. Some people specialize in alcoholism. And when you send an alcoholic to a person that specializes in alcoholism, he'll do a great job because that's a specialty. Just like a person with cancer goes to an oncologist, right? A person with a foot problem will go to an orthopedist. A person with a skin problem goes to a dermatologist. So we live in the world of specialization. And I think that there are great Jewish professionals out there, and even non-Jewish professionals, that they're great experts in addiction. Some people in a very specific type of addiction, they know all the ins and outs, all the kinks, all the quirks, and they have lots of experience, and that is probably a person's best choice when they're selecting a person to help them. Okay, when we talk about rehab, some rehabs do the same thing as well. Some rehabs, they specialize and focus on a particular type of addiction. Other rehabs, they say, oh, well, we'll just take any type of person with any type of addiction, we'll make a big cholent and throw them all together. There's not a lot of hardcore data that I can remember about Pat on this, but when I remember looking into this a few years ago, that was frowned upon. It's kind of bidyevit. Obviously, when you have 100 people together in a hospital for people with depression, you can tailor the treatment a lot better. People can support each other a lot better. The therapists are all experts in depression, and you'll have a much better program than a big salad where all sorts of people with all sorts of problems join all sorts of groups and just do everything together. Okay? So if you are going to send to a treatment program, it should probably be a specialist program that specializes in the addiction that this person has. Okay, individual therapy. There's all sorts of people out there. Maybe if you look at my website at www.jnars.org, go to Recovery Resources. There's a button called Recovery Resources. There, is it there? No, sorry. Go to the Addiction Facts page. Right, that's a button on our website, Addiction Facts page. Click on that button. One of the question and answers in the Addiction Facts page on my website says, how do I know which therapist to pick? Okay, so I have something there, all sorts of questions which you can ask the therapist to see if they're qualified to help the buffer that you're worried about. Also on slide 32, we talk about mutual aid or a support group. And what that is people with the problem helping each other, right? Sometimes there's Ein Chacham Kabal HaNisayon, right? Sometimes it's the addicted person who's growing and recovering that's able to reach out and help somebody else with an addiction. He can say, Shlomi, I was there. I know what it's like to be addicted to pornography. Let me tell you what I did. Let me help you. Okay? So that's mutual aid. And, you know, I think that even if a Rebbe just knows two or three Bachram that have this issue, if you know that one of them is Matzliach and he doesn't mind divulging his identity to the guy who needs help, I think it wouldn't be a bad idea necessarily to have them both go out for a piece of pizza and have a conversation and get in touch with each other. I think it's very, very powerful. That ability for people who had this problem and they can share their experience, strength, and hope, which is an expression in the 12-step groups, if you can share that with somebody else who needs to hear about the experience, strength, and hope, he needs to hear how to free himself from addiction. Okay, support groups. We spoke about the 12-step groups. There's all sorts of support groups out there as well, or therapy groups for that matter, which are a little bit different. Smart recovery is a type of group that exists in a few places in the world. We don't have it yet in Eretz Yisrael, but it's an alternative to the 12-step groups. But any sort of group where you have people together, where there's maybe a person facilitating the group, or maybe there's no one facilitating the group, but it's a group now of 20 people that are in recovery from the same addiction. It's very powerful. They're sharing this experience, or they're working on learning certain tools together. It's very, very powerful. And often, by the way, it's very inexpensive or it's free. That's very important because not everyone has money for treatment. It's free. It's very important to remember. Okay, moving along. On slide 33, we talk about internet filters and treating the environment. I think it is absolutely necessary, and I'm not talking about in halacha, I'm just talking about as a professional, it is so important when a person has internet on his phone, he has on his computer, to have a filter. Okay, we can have a whole 2-hour talk about what type of filter, which ones exist, which ones are matzliach. There's so much to talk about, and we're not going to do that now. There's organizations in the Jewish community like TAG, T-A-G. There's all sorts of people that know a lot about filters out there. But it's a really important thing to deal with. In fact, I usually feel when I have a bacher or a person who's addicted to pornography that I can't even begin treatment if this guy, if I don't work first on treating his environment and maybe trying to put on a filter, because I'm going to be busy working with him on stopping to look at porn. But he's going to be looking at porn the whole week because it's right in his pocket and he has access to it. Okay, so sometimes you can't even open the door for successful treatment until you do something like this. We spoke a lot about pornography, but it's really just one example of how people act out. Okay, I'm trying to be tznia, so I'm trying to talk as least graphic as possible, but just for the sake of not misunderstanding me, filters are important for everybody. And not only for people addicted to pornography, okay? I'll just give it a different example. Let's say you have an avreich or a bacher who is addicted to acting out with men, okay? That's what he does, okay? He finds men through the internet who are interested in having intercourse. And it's through the internet, usually, that he finds these people and he saves their number and then he calls them up. But it's through different websites and all sorts of things, okay? So for him, again, treating his environment and helping him with the internet issue is an important step in opening up the rest of his recovery. Even though he doesn't even look at pornography, this guy. It doesn't have to do only with pornography. That's the point. Okay, slide 34 is very important. Recovery capital. Recovery capital is a very, very important concept. The basic idea is that the more capital that one has to recover, the better the chance is that he can recover. Okay, so I gave an example here. An unemployed person can gain recovery capital by finding a job. When he gets a job, the job can help this person who's addicted to recover indirectly, because a job can empower a person. It can make them feel like a mensch. It can make them feel more dependent. It can make them feel a sense of responsibility. It can help them make money to get money that they need for therapy, for example. They can buy the things that they need. They can feel good about themselves and create a positive social network by meeting all sorts of people at that job, and so on. Instead of only knowing people that he acts out with or only knowing drug addicts, he's going to meet people at his job that are just great regular people. Okay? So just look at a simple thing like finding a job for an unemployed person. It can indirectly give to him 5, 6, 7 powerful things that in his life can help him even more so to recover. Okay, so the more things one has going for him in life, the better his chance is of recovery. And the lesson is, even things which seem to be indirectly related to addiction treatment, those things can have great benefit in helping to recover. Okay, you might say, you know, what does it help for this guy to learn something that he enjoys, you know? Well, it can help big time, especially a bacher who's just depressed in yeshiva. He doesn't understand what's going on at shir. He doesn't like his chavrusa. It's very hard for him to learn this masechta or to learn this topic. Trying to make even that a little bit easier can indirectly help this guy to recover. And when a person feels good and they have good things going for them, it's that much easier to recover. When a person is struggling in 10 different ways, it's that much harder to recover. In fact, while we're on that topic, there's lots of research done about addiction prevention. Okay, addiction treatment costs America billions of dollars per year. So they had scientists for 20, 30 years study what can we do to kids at a young age that will help them that they don't even become addicted. And one of the things they said is, we'll mentor them. We'll make sure they're doing well in school. Because when a kid feels good in school, he feels part of what's going on. He feels accomplished. He feels good about himself. V'kol shekin, this would apply in a yeshiva or any educational Torah setting to any bacher. Okay? Anything else that can help the person feel good about himself, it can give him some extra resources, it can go a very long way. Okay? I see we came to the end of the presentation. Judge me, Lukavskos, if it wasn't that good the way that you expected it to be. It was a bit of a challenge to do this on my own. The original presentation was given in a crowd in Eina Tayra Niknas Ela B'Chabura, right? So when I gave it in live, people asked great questions, they challenged me, and it was just a beautiful presentation. But we work within our limitations, so I hope you enjoy it. I hope that it helps you. One of the questions that people asked at the presentation that I remember was, there's this concept that people think that if a bacher is busy drinking or using drugs or pornography or znus, if he just gets married, if we rush him off and get him married, that is going to help this guy to recover. So I want to tell you just from my own personal experience, I don't think that's true. In other words, it could be true for some people, but I don't think that that's a blanket black and white rule which works. I think the main thing that helps people to recover is helping them feel good about themselves, changing their life, working on the environment, working on the different problems that the person has in his mind, whether he's hung up about his low self-esteem and he thinks that nobody likes him, whether he's depressed because he has social anxiety and he thinks that no one is interested in talking to him, so he doesn't talk to anybody else, whether he's got anxiety, whether he's got problems going on at home, maybe his parents never showed him any love, okay? So he kind of walks around feeling very sad, very unloved, very not part of things, okay? Maybe he's not doing well in yeshiva, and so what is he going to do? What do you want this guy to do? Of course he looks at pornography. He can't talk to anyone and learn because he doesn't know what's going on, you know, etc. Okay? When we do the onion model that I spoke about earlier and we try to break down what are the problems that this person is struggling with, what are the catalysts that kind of move him towards the direction of doing his addiction, and how can I fix those things one by one and help this person feel better about himself, improve his life, help him work out the different various issues going on for him, what are the resources that I can bring into the life of this person that will just help him? If it's 100%, how have I? If I can help him 50%, 60% with these different issues, how have I? Okay? I think that is really the main focus. And of course, if it's time for a bacher to get married and we think he's ready to get married and he's mature enough and he has all the regular things that a bacher needs in order to get married, ma toiv umanoim. If you think that that can help the bacher to be even better off, so that's great. But he has to be someone that's already qualified for marriage. If it's a person that's not even qualified for marriage, and we say, well, we'll just throw him into the ring, and he'll just have to figure it out on his own, and hopefully that itself will help him, I've never seen it work. And I'm not saying that it can't work. I'm not negating anyone else's experience or wisdom or Das Torah, but this was a question that came up when we spoke about it together, when I gave this presentation live. We had a nice discussion about that. And it's something that it's not a given. It's something you have to think about. You have to see if the bacher's ready and so on. Another thing that people spoke about was about shiduchim. Let's say a bacher is in recovery from addiction, and now it's time for shiduchim. Does he have to share this information with the girl or not? Okay. And if we're talking about a girl, does she have to share it with the guy? Okay. I don't want anyone here walking away thinking that addiction only happens to men. It's so not true. It happens to women and to girls. So does the bacher have to share this information or not? So this is a huge responsibility, and you should go ask Das Torah. That's my answer. Now, if there's no Das Torah available right now, or you're just curious to hear my opinion aside from Das Torah, so I'll tell you like this. I think that one of the main things to ask yourself is, Does the Bachar have something going on right now which can possibly reoccur in the future? In other words, let's say the Bachar is not doing that well right now in recovery. So obviously, this guy probably shouldn't be dating. So that's a no-brainer. Let's say he's doing really well in recovery, and he's sober now 6 months to a year, and he's doing really, really great. You could tell he made concrete, significant growth in many domains in his life, and he's just a different person. And of course, he's also not looking at pornography. He's also not sleeping with all these girls, whatever it was that he used to do. He's grown so much. So now the question is, should he share it or not? So I say like this. If this is a chronic problem, which right now he's maintaining, because we spoke about addiction being chronic and you need to maintain it. If there's a certain status quo that he does specific things on a daily basis or weekly basis in order to maintain this situation, and if he doesn't do that, he's going to go back and relapse, so then I think he should share that with the girl. And there's a chachma on how to share it. If he shares it like a fool, then he's going to lose out. He has to share it in the right way without lying, without exaggerating, but there is a proper way to share it. I think that it's only fair for the girl that if she's marrying a guy that's clean right now, but he might relapse 2 years from now when things are very stressful in the house and start doing who knows what, I think that's her right to know before she marries this guy. If it was a minor problem that the professional or expert on hand doesn't even think there's a chance that it will come back, it was a more mild addictive type of issue, the Bachar was entangled for a long time, but in a more mild way, he was just missing kind of like the right tool. You gave him that tool, you met a few times and he got out of it, it was fairly easy, and you don't really see that Bachar is going to go back to the problem. You don't really feel like it was a chronic thing. You don't really expect that even if tons of stress is going on at home, you don't expect him to go back. Then I'm not sure if you have to share that. I mean, why should he have to share it? Do you have to share? Maybe she should share all the schmutzy things that she did, and we don't make her do that, you know what I'm saying? So I think it really has to do with, is it something that may recur and that can affect her? Because it's only fair that if she's going to marry this guy, she should know what might affect her. Okay? How would I say it? Okay? Maybe I would say it like, this is a Bachar that's a great Bachar. He's a really special guy. He's holding in a great place. There was a time when he was struggling with internet pornography, and he came to work on that. And he worked so much and did so well that he's doing fabulous. It's something which he really knows how to keep down pat. He's got all these different skills. He's a new person. It's something that technically may recur in the future if a person doesn't keep up all the things that he needs to do. But this guy, if you want to know, is he motivated to keep up all those things? Has he shown and proven to everyone around him that he's done this for a really long time already? Yeah, of course. So that's the situation. But, but this guy really is doing great. Okay, so maybe I didn't do it the best way now, but that would be maybe a nusach if you put me on the spot for how to say it. You're letting them know that it could be chronic, but at the same time, he's doing a really great recovery. He's doing really well. He's on top of it. He knows how to keep it under wraps. Okay, giving her that confidence, but at the same time, not lying and not exaggerating. I think that's the Derech HaMelech. So, Hatzlacha to everyone. Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. AVITENENBAUM9@gmail.com. Thanks again to Shlavim, SHLAVIM.ORG. Okay? You could check out my website as well, JNARS.ORG. And there we have half the website built right now. And you'll find there resources for professionals, resources for people that want to recover, and an addictions facts page, which is filled with tons of good question and answers about addiction so that people can learn more about what addiction is and how to get better from it. Ultimately, we need a Kadosh Baruch Hu's help. Kadosh Baruch Hu, I daven that you give us all siyata d'shmaya to heal people, the people that you entrust us to help. All the rabbeim out there, Kadosh Baruch Hu, please give them siyata d'shmaya to teach Torah the way that every bachar needs to hear the Torah, and to help guide the Bacharim to Ruchnius and to get close to you, Kadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem should be Matairos and give us Yata Deshmaya. We should be in Am Kadosh. It's Parshas Kadoshim. What a great time to actually be recording this. Hashem should give us just a lot of Yata Deshmaya, and we should be Masliach in our Avodas Hashem.